Today's children will enter an increasingly technological economy where they will compete on a world scale. Researchers say little progress is being made in math and science education. U.S. students continue to lag behind other countries. Two education professors at Michigan State University say reform isn't working because it's not based on scientific evidence. They claim the curriculum in U.S. schools is a mile wide and an inch deep. It lightly touches on too many topics without in-depth rigor. But they're not just crunching numbers in the ivory tower. They're running a five-year pilot project called Promise in 60 school districts in Michigan and Ohio. And they expect to see remarkable improvement in student achievement in science and math. They'll be our guests on Points North right after the news from National Public Radio.
Support for IPR News Radio comes from Traverse City State Bank, committed to fostering a strong community. On the web at tcstatebank.com.
Welcome to Points North. I'm Bob Allen. Children in school today are entering a more technological world with a more global economy. Yet for the last 10 years, testing shows U.S. students' abilities in science and math are stagnant or slipping on an international scale. Some researchers say those results show the education system is the problem, and that we adults are failing our own children because we aren't asking enough of them. One such specialist is Bill Schmidt. He's a distinguished professor at Michigan State University with a doctorate in statistics. Joining him is Joan Farini-Mundy. Joan is a dean in the College of Natural Science at Michigan State and director of the Division of Science and Math Education. Together, they're leading a new program called PROMISE that stands for Promoting Rigorous Outcomes in Mathematics and Science Education. It's a five-year, $35 million partnership with the National Science Foundation, MSU, and a group of five school districts in Michigan and Ohio. The aim of the program is to create a powerful new approach to improving math and science achievement for all students. Bill and Joan, good morning and welcome to Points North.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Thank you for having us.
And I should note that they are joining us from a studio on the campus of Michigan State University in East Lansing. Bill, your specialty is measuring things, and I know you've been paying a lot of attention to these international comparisons of how students in various countries are doing in learning science and math. What do the latest figures show about U.S. students?
Well, the latest figures actually just confirm what we first discovered in 1997 when we put out the first of these studies called the Third International Math and Science Studies, or TIMSS. Then we found that the performance of U.S. students was about average at fourth grade, dropped to below average by eighth grade, and by the end of 12th grade, we're essentially near the bottom of the international distribution. The recent test in 2003 of TIMSS, but also of PISA, essentially confirms this and shows that not much has changed over the last set of years and that we're virtually in the same position we were in 1997.
And how definitive are these results? Is there much argument about them?
Not really. The results are relatively clear. I mean, one could argue about the exact ranking and things of that sort, but what's very clear is the U.S. performance is not very stellar. It essentially drops over the years from fourth grade, which I think is an important finding because it really suggests that the problem is not with the students, with the children, but probably it's our system because essentially we drop, our performance drops over the years so that relatively speaking we're in a worse position by the end of schooling. And I think that clearly points the finger in the direction of our system of education.
And how do you think the system is failing?
Well, essentially, what we've learned from a lot of that international work is that a big portion of the problem has to do with the nature of the curriculum. Our country's expectations in math and science are not very high. We don't expect students to move as they go past fourth grade into more serious mathematics and serious science in the middle grades. In these other countries, the middle grades, what they call lower secondary, are extremely challenging and essentially serve as a bridge from the more primary grades through to the high school. And those years then move people, like in mathematics, into algebra and geometry and science, into chemistry, physics, and biochemistry, while we're still playing with arithmetic and what I call rocks and body parts. And basically, that then leaves our students some 2 years, we estimate, behind the rest of the world's children. And then in high school, we just can't make it up. So that's one major component. The other one is we are learning more and more that teachers are necessary, of course, to deliver the curriculum, and their subject matter knowledge and their knowledge about how to teach that subject matter are essentially very important factors as well. So I'd say those are the two dimensions that seem to be most important.
Joan, those international measurements of student achievement seem to jive with what classroom teachers observe, that up until fourth grade, students are, in general, still pretty curious about basic science and math, and then it begins to drop off pretty dramatically after that. What do you think is the main reason for that?
Well, I'm sure it's a complicated set of reasons. I think that in mathematics, there's sort of a societal expectation that being only moderately good at doing mathematics is okay, unlike other countries where there's a high premium placed on excellence in mathematics and science. There's this unfortunate phenomenon in the U.S. where we'll tolerate, even in social situations, saying things like, well, I've always had trouble with mathematics. So part of it's an expectation issue. Part of it's a motivation issue. These are subjects that are inherently fascinating, at least to those of us who've studied them at some depth. And it's important for teachers to be able to convey the excitement of these subjects, to be able to help kids understand that these are interesting and engaging areas, while at the same time maintaining a high cognitive demand so that the expectations are sustained and so that kids, as Bill says, get a chance to move more deeply into more substantial content in these areas.
There are all kinds of education reform efforts out there. This new program you're running in schools is based, as you said, on curriculum. Why focus it that way?
Well, there have been a lot of efforts and lots of investment over the last many decades in trying to improve school mathematics and science, many of them very sharply focused on the matter of teacher professional development and improving teachers' capacity to teach specific topics and to teach specific approaches, really, to math and science. And so the new finding from the international work that Bill Schmidt and his colleagues have brought to us around curriculum and the need for coherent curriculum and the need for curriculum that deepens across the grades rather than repeats ideas, all of that seems to be a really exciting foundation and strategy for how to make improvements in the system that's a little bit different from the strict focus on helping teachers improve the day-to-day work that they do in classrooms. And so our idea and promise is to use those sorts of international data and findings together with more specific findings about curriculum in our partner districts as the basis for designing professional development programs for teachers that help them work toward high standards, high expectations, coherent curricular approaches, and expecting more of their students.
Bill,
so it's a combination.
Okay. Bill, what suggestions do you have or are you making in changing curriculum?
Well, I think we've, as Joan just said, one of the singly most important findings, I think, that comes out of our work is the notion of coherence. I think that one of the little phrases.
What do you mean by coherence?
Well, I was just going to explain that. In fact, one of the phrases that came out of our earlier work is the mile wide, inch deep curriculum, which meant that we covered many topics and nothing in depth. It turns out probably that's just a symptom, that the real issue is this coherence. And by that we mean that the sequencing of topics, both within a grade and across grades, should reflect, to some degree at least, the internal logic of the discipline itself. In other words, the topics that we teach in called math and science are based essentially on the academic disciplines of mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, etc. And those then school versions should reflect those disciplines upon which they're based. And this then is the notion of coherence, that the degree to which the sequencing of topics and the coverage reflects that internal structural nature of the discipline, that's what we mean by coherence. the absence of that leads to somewhat of an arbitrary collection of topics that are put together that don't necessarily lead anywhere. They're just a sequence of topics. And we all know that when things are not connected in some deeper way, it's much more difficult to get a handle on it, to remember it. And I think that issue of coherence then becomes really central to why it is that our children don't learn things very well, because to them they're just learning a series of things that seem unconnected, and that's the coherence issue.
And could you give an example of how you would change a curriculum in a specific subject to make it more coherent from one grade level to another?
Sure. There's actually two kinds of coherence as we're beginning to identify it. We think of the more of the coherence that happens within a topic, perhaps even within a grade. And then there's the what we have sort of called the macro coherence, which refers to how the bigger topics sort of fit together and sequence themselves across the grades. Let me illustrate the first ones that I mentioned first, and that is that take a topic like fractions. It's covered in our school system anywhere from second grade, even sometimes up to ninth or tenth grade. And the way in which it's generally presented doesn't necessarily build over the grades. It's just we keep repeating somewhat the same kinds of things. So students learn they have to add these things, they have to subtract them, they have to multiply them. But a more coherent approach takes and in one grade develops the very concept of fractions and doesn't do it the way we traditionally have, but relates it to the number line so that it's related to the rest of what they've done in the earlier grades. Actually, that's a bit of the macro coherence, where they see fractions as just an extension of whole numbers. And they need to learn that, in fact, the principles, the properties that govern whole number arithmetic are pretty much the same as the ones that govern the fractions. And, in fact, that the fractions and the whole numbers go together into something bigger called the rational number system. And so all of this is to bring them to the sense that this stuff is all interconnected, that it builds, it progresses. And so within an area like fractions, you begin to lay the foundations conceptually, then you build on notions of equivalence, and then you build on that leading into things like adding and subtracting. And all of this just progresses. We've sort of referred to this in our work with the teachers in the project as building content trajectories, which sort of means we want them to think of these, what they're doing in a given topic at a given grade, even at a given day within the school year, is part of a trajectory, which means it's leading somewhere. It's not just an isolated element, but it rather is part of a bigger picture.
Well, Joan, I'm wondering how do we get into the situation where we have these isolated elements, these sort of unconnected lessons that go on in the schools?
Well, a lot of it, of course, is historical. The country's curriculum has developed as an amalgamation, really, of what was commonly done in schools beginning, 100 years ago, which was heavily focused on arithmetic, and then that evolved through the new math era, for example, with a very strong focus on some very formal aspects of mathematics that turned out not to play out very well either with kids in schools and with teachers. And so we're partly a product of our history, and I think these sorts of international comparative studies give us a real good push for saying, let's take another whole new look at the way that U.S. curriculum in mathematics and science is organized. Another, I guess, obvious factor is that the teachers that we work with are really are a product of this curriculum. So the curriculum that they've experienced as K through 12 students has these features of being a mile wide and an inch deep, of being disconnected, and it's a real challenge then for teacher education programs and for continuing professional development programs for teachers to try to remedy this sense of disconnectedness. Well, so we focus very... Oh, I'm sorry. Go
ahead. I was going to ask you, how do you convince educators to make the change?
Well, part of it is making sure that they have the capacity to make that change. That is, that they have the knowledge and background themselves to see the sorts of connections that that we think are really crucial for the curriculum as it shifts. And so, for example... Bill has given a small example about fraction. Fraction typically gets taught with four or five different models conceptually. The fraction as a piece of pie kind of model, or the fraction as number of people with blue shirts on in a group of folks in a room, or the number of or, you know, sort of location on a number line or the result of a division problem. And we've examined curricular materials, and most of those models get included, but the connections between them aren't made explicitly. And teachers, by and large, probably haven't had much experience trying to think about how one of those models leads to the next, and then ultimately gets consolidated into the idea of fraction as a number. And we have lots and lots of examples of that, both in mathematics and in science. So our work is about trying to help the teachers see those connections. Our work is not about handing them a sort of ready-made curriculum, because they will work with a range of instructional materials and with standards and so forth, but rather to be really good consumers of, or even connoisseurs of, standards and curricular materials, and that they can make those connections themselves on the basis of stronger subject matter understanding.
Okay. We're talking about improving science and math education with researchers Joan Farini-Mundy and Bill Schmidt at Michigan State University here on Points North. If you have a question or you want to make a comment on this topic, please give us a call at 276-4500, or you can call us toll-free at 800-442-9422. We've heard on this show before that there's not much time or money for teacher development in schools. How will they get all this training that they need to help themselves figure out how to make their lessons more coherent? Joan or Bill?
Well, our project Promise is certainly one attempt at creating models for teacher professional development, models that we hope will have a lasting residue, in that there will be print materials that will get produced here, but also a web-based online resource that we're working on that would make it possible for teachers to access a lot of this kind of material and resource material at whatever time they would like. Now, it's also the case that schools and school systems and school districts have programs of professional development for their teachers. They have teacher workshop days and some built-in parts of their budget that allow for them to bring in experts and so on to work with teachers. And it will be our hope, at least through our project, that districts increasingly get interested in the sort of professional development that we're developing, and that that's what they use in their district-level PD day offerings.
Okay.
If I could just add to that.
Sure.
I think that the other part of this is that that we probably need to think really seriously and deeply about how we prepare these teachers. Joan responded to what the situation is currently, which is those teachers that are already out there. And I think that we're actually doing another study which looks internationally at how teachers are prepared. And one finds in some of these countries whose children do much better than we do on these tests that, in fact, a lot of the issues that we're talking about are actually part of their formal curriculum, so that they get a deep understanding of the mathematics, let's say, but also they're constantly, during their teacher preparation period, are learning some of these subtler issues about how you think about these things like trajectories, how you build these things, how you select materials that are consistent with it. So I think it's both, we need to attack it on both fronts, because if we don't do the actual teacher preparation part, there's a longer road, because we'll keep producing teachers who need to be seriously to be involved in professional development. So I think both approaches become critical in this arena.
Okay. We're going to take a call, but before we do, Bill, could you please get a little closer to your microphone? You're just a little bit distant right now.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes. Let's take a call from Sue in Glen Arbor. Sue, welcome to Points North.
Hi. Thanks for having it.
You're welcome.
I was listening to the conversation, and I applaud all the changes in research, and I just wanted to mention the fact that I think one of the things in our society and in this country that they've touched upon is that we still have to motivate these kids from the inside out, and we can give them anything we want from the outside, but if these kids don't think that they can do math, then they're still going to struggle no matter how we present it, which is the problem we've seen when they've changed the systems. I have three daughters in the system who are now in college, and the only way that I've been able to get them to still love math, which all kids do when they're little, is to tell them that it is never the fault of the child. it is the fault of the system. So I think that then when they do this program, we have to empower these kids also with the capacity of each of them to be able to do math, physics, calculus, because that is what's also different in these other countries, that the women in India and the men in India have as motivation the success of engineering, for instance. Mm-hmm. So because we've literally changed schools, if we can't keep a child motivated in math, then we say, then there's a problem with the school, try to fix it, what do you want to do? And if you can't circumvent the problem, then you need to go somewhere else, because somehow you have to keep these kids motivated, or when they get to school, they're not going to pick engineering.
Okay.
And if they do, they're not going to be creative about it.
Thanks a lot, Sue. Appreciate your comment.
Thank you.
Joan, you've talked about motivation and attitudes. How do you deal with that inside-out type of motivation?
Well, I mean, Sue is absolutely right. It's a crucial matter. I think a starting point is to be sure that teachers understand how important this is to convey to kids that they believe in them, that they believe that it's possible for everyone to learn mathematics. We have an enormous achievement gap between black students and white students in this country in mathematics. And this notion of expectation is central to improving that gap, to improving the participation of underrepresented groups and women in science and engineering. So kids with parents who are like Sue and understand how important this is, I think it's terrific. It's hard to work on this, actually, with teachers. Sometimes research can help. They can understand that children in certain settings that look like the ones that they work in actually can do very, very well, and therefore they need to hold high expectations for all kids. But it's one of the toughest problems to work on because it requires support not just from teachers, but from families and communities and the general society to say that everyone should have the opportunity to learn and can do well. In the 80s, there used to be a lot more programs specifically targeted at women, at minority students, to try to interest them in math and science and engineering. And I've seen less of that in the last decade, last 15 years even. But that was a very popular approach in those years, and there was some evidence that those kinds of programs made a difference. And so it may also be time to sort of revisit that approach.
And you said earlier,
I just wanted
to follow up with something that Joan said earlier, that we tolerate poor math skills. Why do you think we as a society do that?
That's a good question. Perhaps because excellence in mathematics is a sort of rare thing in the society. It's a small number of people who actually go on to become mathematicians. It's not as rampant, for example, as excellence in literacy, which is an expectation of the society simply to function. The thing is that today, excellence in quantitative skill is really a requirement for functioning in the society, for being able to make sound decisions about policy options, to be able to simply function in the workplace. Mm-hmm. So it's a shift that I think is bound to happen one way or another, because the competitive issues are going to come to the fore.
And you wanted to add something, Bill?
Yeah, I was just going to say on the motivation issue that I think that actually, even though it is internal what she's talking about, that the very nature of the way we structure the curriculum could have a powerful impact on that. If students see mathematics as just this completely redundant, repetitive, sort of isolated coverage of things that they have to do, tons and tons of pages of computations on the basis of, then they sort of, why would you like that necessarily? It doesn't seem very exciting to me. But if you present mathematics in the deeper ways so that you can see these connections, then it becomes a lot more interesting and exciting. So I think that would facilitate help in all of the things that Joan mentioned.
Okay. You're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. We're talking about improving science and math education with two researchers from Michigan State University. Let's take another call now from Jim in Traverse City. Welcome to Points North, Jim. Go ahead, Jim. You there? Let's try Lois in Sutton's Bay. Lois, welcome to Points North.
Yes, good
morning. You're on the air.
Yes. My point that I wanted to bring up was, number one, I've taught in the trenches for 11 years, and so I've seen from kindergarten through 12th grade, you know, the different curriculums. I've also substitute taught, so I've been in different districts. So So I've seen a wide range of teaching going on. And you're talking about math and science curriculum. When you team that with the other curriculums that are supposed to be taught by to be up to snuff with the state, mm-hmm. so we get our funding, mm-hmm. There's only so much time in a day for the teachers to do their prep work, to take care of the lessons, to work with the students. And there's just such a time crunch anymore for everything that is supposed to be taught in the classroom that, you know, we're just doing the mile wide and the inch deep. And
so you're saying the curriculum sort of takes a back seat?
There's so much that is required in every single subject to be taught. Mm-hmm. You know, each curriculum is packed full, and the teachers don't have enough time to work with the students. Now, some of the districts are using an hour and a half every other day subject time now with their students. And I think that's really making a difference because, you know, if a student has just 10 minutes with instruction time and then they have to go to their seat and there's 20 or 30 students, not every student gets the help that they might need for understanding. Then they go home, their parent might not understand. They come back, they're frustrated, they didn't understand. The time goes on, they have to go on to the next subject. And so they haven't gotten that pocket of understanding that they need. You know, not putting a fault in anybody, and that student might be trying as hard as they can. Mm-hmm. So is the teacher. And then the professional development time, that's great. You know, you get a half a day off, and you go to professional development. Do you get any more time after that to actually work on developing that? No, because you have other lesson plans. And so it's just a treadmill for the student and the teacher and the parents to keep everything involved, and it's still mile wide, inch deep.
Thanks a lot, Melissa. Thank you.
Thank you.
So what do you think, Bill or Joan, what do you do about the time crunch, and how are you designing your program to try to deal with that on the very most practical level that the teachers and the students face?
Well, I think Lois has has it correctly. That is that it is part of the mile wide, inch deep, which exists not just within a subject matter, but across the subject matters. And I think one solution or one help to this is if we tended to view subject matters more in this building trajectory sense, we wouldn't have so many topics at every grade level, that children would have more time to absorb the concept before moving on to the next one. I was always been struck by the fact that in these other countries, students often have as much as a month or several weeks at least to master a certain concept, which in this country we simply expect them to get in a day or a week or some shorter period of time. So I think part of that would be if that was across the entire curriculum, that if there was a more focused approach that wasn't just collections of things, but it rather was a set of topics and ideas building within each of these disciplines, that there would be less of what she worries about, which is that there's so much to do for the teachers to prepare for. So I think that would be one thing. And I think states, to some extent, are trying to do this now with the newer standards, is to cut down on the number of topics per grade in each of the subject matters and to give it more of a sensible flow. I think that could be a very important part of trying to reduce the burden on the teachers. I think the other one that I'd quickly mention is I think schools need to think seriously more and more about moving to specialists to teach at different grade levels. Again, one sees that especially prevalent in the middle grades, that it isn't one teacher that it's expected to teach all of these subject matters, which is really, when you get into a more sophisticated areas, is pretty much impossible for the teacher to do that. So I think that that's another reasonable approach that school districts ought to consider.
Could I just add that one additional sort of remedy for this, and Lois is right, it's a serious challenge and problem that I think the system has to try to work on collectively. But another remedy is to do a better job in the development of standards at looking across disciplines. I mean, there are important connections that could be made between mathematics and science, science and social studies, and so forth, that I don't think really show up in standards typically. For example, in our program, we we did some professional development with science teachers on sun, earth, moon system as a way to try to work on their basic understanding of systems. And as we were getting into it, we realized it was a terrific opportunity to do great work with angles and planes and three-dimensional geometry relationships. But those things aren't typically connected. We sort of do science in one place and math in another. And so until we move toward a system of specialists, which I also support at the elementary grades, a little bit more work in the standards development efforts at connecting across the disciplines would help a bit with this problem. But it's really becoming very serious, I agree.
Okay, let's take another call now. John's been waiting in ACME. Thanks for waiting, John. Welcome to Points North.
Hi. I should say that I'm a retired math teacher, and I've heard a lot about new programs, and when you first hear their descriptions, it's hard to argue with them, but when you see them implemented, most of them have been failures. Most recently, the core math program, which is used here in Traverse City and which was developed at Michigan State, it has really been a failure, I think. Students who go to school districts that use the core math program were shown not to be able to be successful at math and science at Michigan State. Students who go through the core math program here have to take a remedial math program when they enter NMC here. So now we have another group of professors from Michigan State touting a new math program. Why should this one be any different?
Okay, good question, John. Thanks. How would you respond, Joan?
I'll start and then Bill will pick up. But I want to be clear about a couple of things. We are not touting any sort of particular curricular materials. What we are talking about is a bigger view of standards and expectations and goals for instruction that that would need to be carried out locally by local districts who will choose. Did we lose you, Bob?
No, we lost the caller.
Okay.
Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who will choose their own instructional materials? So that's the first clarification I want to make. That's a district level decision. Our goal is to help teachers have the skills and backgrounds to work with standards and aim for coherence. And the other thing I would want to point out is that the Core Plus material that that the caller is speaking about actually is not an MSU developed program. But I'll let Bill pick up with this. The questions about how particular instructional materials do or don't prepare students for entering college are complicated.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't have much to add here, but I would just say that he's correct. I mean, it looks in the United States like we just constantly are trying new versions of varying things. But that's, I think, what Joan said is very important. This Promise Project is not about a packaged program of any sort. What we're going back to is the fundamental principles of mathematics and of the varying sciences, and asking and thinking about how those should impact what instruction looks like. We're working both across Michigan and Ohio. I don't know for an exact fact, but I think one tabulation we did not so long ago showed that as many as 40 different textbooks across all the 600 schools we're working with. So we're not trying to necessarily push for any single program or textbook, but what we're trying to say is, if you have whatever materials you have, how should you think about those mathematically or from the point of view of the sciences to actually make those materials more consistent with this concept of coherence? So it's not about a particular Promise is not about a particular program.
That's Bill Schmidt at Michigan State University, a distinguished professor, as is Joan Farini-Monday. They're our guests on Points North. We're going to take a little break, but you can join the conversation or ask a question by giving us a call at 276-4500 or 800-442-9422. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Bob Allen. We're joined by Bill Schmidt and Joan Farini-Monday, education researchers at Michigan State University. The $35 million for the PROMISE program from the National Science Foundation, Bill, how far does that take you in designing what you want to do for these school districts that you're working with?
If you could see me, you would realize I was smiling at this point, because I think everybody at this at university that when we got this $35 million grant thought, oh my gosh, that's such a huge amount of money. And it seems like it, and of course it is. But when you begin to look at the particular problems and begin to think of the magnitude of what you have to do, and across 600 schools, as I said, in 60-some districts, and given the level of knowledge that the teachers have in mathematics and in the varying sciences, the problem is just enormous, and the $35 million only begins to help us to scratch the surface, as they say. I think what we realized very early on is, given the seriousness of the issue, that the only way we could really bring this to scale, which is the Washington jargon for saying making it work at a large enough system across multiple districts and so forth, mm-hmm. is to probably go to some kind of virtual system. So we're trying, as Joan mentioned much earlier, build some kind of a web-based system that would allow us to reach even larger numbers of teachers. So we're trying that combination, both of personal contact as well as virtual contact. And it's even with that, it's still, I think, very difficult to bring about the changes, even in just some 60 districts. And I say just some 60 when you consider the fact we have 15,000 plus in this country. So it's an enormous task, and mm-hmm. this only begins to help us to start the process.
Well, at the end of 5 years, what might you have that could be replicated in either the same schools that you've been working with or in other schools across the country? How would you gear this up?
Well, I think that the key is, and one of the things...
Assuming it works, of course.
Yes, of course. One of the things the National Science Foundation is interested in is that we are, as a project, a microcosm of the U.S. We have large urban districts involved, like Cleveland. We have small rural districts, like we have here in Michigan, in St. Clair County and in Calhoun County. And so what we're learning across all of these districts is valuable to figuring out how you could take this up to the national scale. I think the other part of this is that we have uniquely, in many ways, a very heavy research component to this project. We are studying everything we do. We have baseline data. At the beginning of the project, we tested some 200,000 students in every grade from 3 through 12, and we have rich data on the teachers and what they cover, and we're using all of that together with what we do with them to learn and to build scientifically valid models, statistical models that show the relationship. So in the end, we hope we will learn, yes, that a lot of this works, but also under what circumstances. We are already seeing that there are certain contextual factors embedded in the districts, the leadership component, the way they're structured, all of which impacts on how successful we appear to be being with some of these ideas. So I think we'll learn because we're going to study this. This is not just providing professional development. This is a very strongly based research part of the study that looks at all of these issues and then tries to learn from them.
And Joan, can you talk any more about what solutions you may be finding right now that could work on a larger scale or could be applied in other places?
Well, certainly in the work that we're doing with teachers, the professional development, and actually we're now calling it capacity building, because it really is broader than traditional meanings for professional development. We're finding some interesting trends that our research model will ultimately, I think, help us to codify into something really concrete. One is that when we work with teachers around a very specific topic that they might at first think is quite narrow, say linear equations with middle school teachers. We had teachers say to us, how can you possibly spend 4 days of full-day professional development focusing on linear equations and linear functions? That's a topic that we kind of cover, in a day. Mm-hmm. And by the end, they were coming away saying, you know, it wasn't even enough time. We still needed more time. This is so deep to understand this fundamentally. And then what we're seeing is that these teachers are going back to their districts and asking to sort of to hijack the professional development time that's been set aside in the district to do similar kinds of activities with more teachers in their districts. So we're starting to see the multiplier effect that we had built into the design in the first place happening in certain situations where this focus on what one researcher, Li-Ping Ma, calls profound understanding of fundamental mathematics and science, where that's becoming a value now in this project among the teachers. And they're bringing this back into their districts and working to help their colleagues. So we'll study that and hopefully be able to talk about how and under what conditions that happens well.
Let's go to a caller now. Let's hear from Lynn in Beulah. Welcome to Points North, Lynn. Lynn, can you hear me? Apparently not. So we'll go to Tom in Arcadia. Tom, welcome to Points North. Tom, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I'm a retired engineer who was part of the Sputnik generation who said was told that, you know, gosh, we need engineers really badly. Spent 35 years in industry and used my engineering degree, but I don't think that engineering degrees are what industry wants. I think the people who got promoted to higher management, in my experience, were people with finance majors, people with business majors, and heaven forbid at the end, people with law degrees. And so you had technical people working for people who had law degrees. So I'm not sure that the industry wants what you guys are trying to sell.
You don't think it has as much value as maybe it's being made out to have, eh?
At least not in my case.
Do you have any response to that, Bill or Joan?
Yes, I do. I think that what Tom is suggesting may have been perhaps the case up until fairly recently, but if you read any of the major reports that are coming out of the Business Roundtable or any of those business-oriented organizations, the shocking and scary result is that we are having the baby boom engineers, perhaps of which Tom is one, now retiring or beginning to retire, and we simply don't have replacements for them. And industry is concerned. The new information technology industry is yearning to have more engineers to provide the basis for what they do. And Intel and others have simply come out to say that we're at a tipping point or approaching it, so that if we don't produce more of this sort, most of what they do will simply go elsewhere into other countries, especially in the Southeast Asia. The more recent report shows that by the year 2010, which is not very far from now, basically it's like 75% of the world's engineers and scientists will reside in Southeast Asia and China and India and those countries. So I think we're at a point now where everybody recognizes that we don't have what we need just to replace what is beginning to retire. And I think industry is saying this will cause a serious hardship. And in fact, for those who say, well, that's for the engineers, I don't wish to be one, it doesn't bother me, those latest projections suggest that the personal income of the Americans will change, will drop. And that's the first such projection of that sort for quite some time. So this has implications all the way across the board for our economy as a whole, not just specifically for our needs in those particular industries.
Let's take another call now from Jim in Traverse City. Jim, welcome to Points North.
Yes, hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Yes, I am from a very non-math science background and did reasonably well in the world, although I basically did not fit in at all with math or science. And I'm wondering this, to what extent is the American low ranking with other countries affected by the fact that we tend to do everything to keep kids in school up through the 12th grade? Perhaps some of these other countries that we're being compared with don't have universal education or don't have universal high school education, or perhaps they push kids into different tracks at an earlier age so that only those kids who have some ability in math and science are taking math and science at the 7th or certainly at the 11th or 12th grade.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Is it a fair comparison, Bill?
Yes, I think Jim's perception is one that's held by quite a few Americans, that these international comparisons aren't really fair, because they suffer from the problems he suggested. That's simply not true. In this past set of studies called TIMSS, they were regulated by Statistics Canada, which is the equivalent of the U.S. Census Bureau, and so there were highly structured rules about how the samples had to be drawn, etc. And I can tell you this, that essentially the image many Americans have about these other countries is no longer true. It was true, I think. I'm not an historian, but I think it was true shortly after World War II. But now these countries have virtually, at eighth grade, which is one of the key comparison points, except virtually 100% of their students are in school, and they're not being tracked, and the study was done across all students, not just the mathematically elite. And if you want to hear a startling statistic, that at the 12th grade, it turns out that the U.S. has a very small percentage among the world, is more developed countries, of its students still in school. We only have some around 65 to 70% of our students of the age cohort still in high school at the 12th grade. Other countries, it's much higher, virtually 90% in many of these. And so the comparisons are very fair. We worked very hard to make sure that, in fact, they cut across the board and didn't just reflect some country's elite.
Okay. Let's take another call now from Lynn in Beulah. Lynn?
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning, and welcome to Points North.
Yes, hi. First, I want to tell Bill and Joan how thrilled I am with what they're trying to do. I'm a mathematics curriculum coordinator, retired, and work for local ISDs, and also as a trainer for one of the 3NSF-funded elementary programs. And I just have two points that I want to make and have addressed, and then I'll take my answer off the phone.
Okay.
One is the fragility that I see in attempts at reform, and which has been mentioned, that has both external and internal connections. One is that our schools change so much as we, I think about Japan. I spent a summer in Japan watching school children until August when they had their break. And I watched teachers working 4 hours a day at their actual teaching while they had planning and meeting time and work with students for the other hours in the day, a luxury that American teachers don't have. I see the changing populations in schools, not only of students who come and go from schools, but teachers coming in and changing schools and changing jobs. And as has been mentioned, the tremendous demand on teacher time, so that with all these external forces pulling against them, their chances to maintain change once programs end for them is difficult. Mm. The other is that I'm concerned about the coherence of a program when there is no basic curriculum being used. Because I go again into schools, many schools where talented teachers have done some wonderful things with curriculum, some of the things we'd hope they do, but there is no coherence among the grades. So that these teachers, though trying to do a beautiful job as new teachers come in, as other teachers don't follow suit, they become sort of islands or oases in an otherwise not very organized situation. And I watch the program I train for again and again fall short after a time, and the initial enthusiasm when attention turns to grade-level content expectations or the new reading program or whatever. Mm-hmm. Any comments from either of you to give me some hope?
Well,
those are some pretty big issues.
Yeah, they are. You've identified huge issues, and I just wanted to pick up on a couple of them. The teacher and student mobility issues are very, very serious, and we see that in our urban sites in this project. You know, we had this kind of nice theoretical design at the beginning that that we're modifying and having to adapt because these are huge issues. One solution to that kind of thing is more uniformity, certainly by state, and I think increasingly we're seeing states banding together to think about cross cross-state standards. There's a group of New England states, for instance, that's using a single set of standards and being assessed to those standards across, you know, three or four different states. We don't have national curriculum in the United States, but I think there's a movement toward getting more agreement about what would happen, particularly in mathematics, roughly in each grade. The National Council of Teachers of Mathematics is coming out with a document very soon called Curriculum Focal Points that's going to lay out recommendations for what ought to be the major big ideas of mathematics at each grade. So hopefully there's movement that would help with the this mobility question create some more uniformity in the system.
Does that mean giving up local control?
No. It means sort of laying out what big themes would be like in ways that then hopefully converge with local state-level standards and grade-level content expectations. But then it still is a matter of individual districts and even grades figuring out how to arrange their own instructional materials and pedagogy in a way that helps students learn to those goals. Mm-hmm. That's always going to be a challenge and always, I think, needs to remain a possibility for districts. The cross-grade discussions that that are mentioned also, I think, are really important because in this work we're trying to do with trajectories, we're working both with what I guess we're calling in our some of our lingo, mini trajectories and macro trajectories. So there's the fraction trajectory that might all happen within a third grade classroom versus fractions as it leads to ratio and proportion, as it leads to proportional reasoning, and then as that leads to linear functions. That's a big trajectory that ought to be discussed by teachers across the K through 12 spectrum. And so we're pushing as much as we can for models of how to do cross-grade conversation and professional development as well. There's a lot of research to suggest that curriculum-specific professional development can ultimately make a difference in student achievement. But that tends to mean professional development that is focused on the subject matter more so perhaps than on using the exact materials that the teachers would have in their classrooms at any given time.
Mm. We just have a couple minutes left, but Bill, in some of the materials from the Promise Program, you're quoted as saying, "No one knows what it takes to dramatically improve learning in math and science." If you don't have a magic answer, what leads you to believe that this Promise Program is going to create a powerful new approach to improving achievement for students?
Well, I think that some 10 years worth of research, both across the world as well as other studies, have pretty clearly established the two dominant factors that need to be concentrated on. Is the curriculum along the lines of developing coherent, rigorous, high-demanding curriculum? And by that, by the way, I mean a set of standards of expectations clearly laid out as to what is to be done at each of the grade levels, not a particular set of curriculum materials, not a particular textbook, not a particular approach. I think we get confused by that sometimes. And I don't think the answer lies in that narrow corner. I think the answer is more in terms of developing coherent trajectories across grades, of things that need to be covered, of topics that need to be developed in math and science. So I think that's one of the two major components. And the other one is that we help to develop in the teachers a deep understanding of that subject matter that they're teaching, including the kinds of mathematics or science that is part of the formal logic of the discipline, but it's more related specifically to the teaching of it rather than perhaps doing research on one of those topics in some abstract sense. So I think those are the two things. It's about teachers and what they know about their subject matters, and it's about that curriculum that needs to be put together in some kind of a coherent fashion. And I may startle your readers with this next comment, but you set me up for it a moment ago, and that is I think that one of the solutions in this country is to seriously considering having nationally based standards. This is my opinion, not Promise's, not anybody else's, but my research has led me to believe that that ultimately is where we might need to go in order to accomplish those two things I just talked about.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks a lot, Bill Schmidt, distinguished professor at Michigan State University, and Joan Farini-Mundy, also a professor at MSU. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for your phone calls. Peter Piette has been on the phones. Jack Connors is our engineer. And I'm Bob Allen. Thanks a lot. This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio.